Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik, where we bring you news, politics, and culture without the red and blue treatment. My name is Bob Schlehuber. I'm here with my co-host, Michelle Witte. Get ready to go against the grain. We're here with you today from 12 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Big show here today for us. Michelle, I want to ask you how you're doing today, but let me start with me. Bob, how are you feeling? Well, thanks for asking, Bob. I actually feel great, feeling super strong, safer, and may I say, invincible? That's how I'm doing. But no, Michelle, how are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm fine, Bob. And I can hear you really working hard at keeping that baritone going while you're up there in your homeland.
Oh, yeah.
So congratulations, Bob. You sound like this. It's really soothing. You sound really authoritative. let me ask, other than your new low voice, what's got you feeling so great? Is there something in the water in Rockford?
Well, it's not the water. You know, actually, I just don't ask about the water. Let the water set aside. Anyways, no, Michelle, I feel great because I took the COVID-19 vaccine. Took a jab in the thigh, took jabs in both arms, loaded me up. And really, why wait a month between two shots when you can go ahead and take three shots the first time?
Okay. First of all, Bob, definitely not how vaccines work. So you are failing on that front. But while I am concerned for your health, I am also intrigued. Bob, how did you get yourself a vaccine ahead of most of our medical workers, seniors, and really don't miss the emphasis on this here, buddy, essential workers?
Oh, wow. Wow. Interesting, Michelle. It's quite simple, though. To ensure continuity of Sputnik shows, one host from each of our programs got the jab. That way we can make sure we bring our listeners endless news, politics, and culture throughout the pandemic.
Quick follow-up there, Bob. Did I miss an email?
Whoa. Michelle, it's not about me and you. This is about our listeners. It's about continuity. Honestly, you're sounding a lot like Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who called it disturbing that her fellow lawmakers were able to vaccinate before most of the country's frontline workers and the elderly. Omar went on to even slam fellow squad member Rep. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a 31-year-old, for getting the vaccine before senior citizens. Omar tweeted of the jab distribution to Congress people, "It's now clear that we don't have enough vaccines for everybody, and there is a shortage of supply. We have to prioritize those who need it the most." And all joking aside regarding my own fake jabs, Omar is speaking from a place of personal pain. Omar lost her father to complications from COVID-19 in June, and has railed against the Trump administration's response to the pandemic throughout. But continuity of government, the U.S. government that has failed its people mightily over the last year while still waging war around the world, must be protected at the expense of its people. It's absolutely disgusting that 31-year-olds like AOC, who are Twitter heroes, jumped the line ahead of heroic medical students working on the front lines at hospitals and clinics across the country. So to those who have lost loved ones like Omar to the virus, I feel you on this one. To those standing in line for food, who are afraid that they will be or have already been evicted. To those who feel ashamed that they've lost their jobs, I feel you on this one. To those struggling who must watch lawmakers who have done so little for so few get a vaccine that lets them sleep at night while a national nightmare continues to roll out, we feel you on this one.
Bob, can you guess how I feel? No guesses there? Speechless? It's a little mad, Bob. I've got more to delight you with. The COVID-19 relief bill that was passed last night also helps take care of our members of Congress by doubling the budget of their exclusive health clinic. The Office of Attending Physician, which provides medical services to lawmakers, received a special boost of $5 million, more than doubling its annual budget, which is currently around $4.27 million. And The Intercept, which reported on this budget boost, says the OAP, the Office of Attending Physician, is described as some of the country's best and most efficient government-run healthcare. And in addition to employing several doctors and nurses to provide on-call treatment to legislators on Capitol Hill, it also provides the services of a chiropractor, on-site physical therapy, radiology, routine examinations, and a pharmacist. And now, Bob, I'm a little confused because I thought government-run healthcare was a nightmare, this scourge that both parties have been fighting valiantly to protect us from. And here they are suffering through it themselves day after day on Capitol Hill. How brave of them, Bob. No wonder they needed $5 million more dollars. Also, someone who has gotten some physical therapy in her life, I want to highlight physical therapy a little bit here. Physical therapy costs a fortune. Even with quote unquote good insurance, physical therapy often isn't covered, or you have to travel across hill and dale to find someone who will take your insurance plan. But physical therapy can be really, really important to people. It can really, really improve your quality of life. It preserves strength. It preserves mobility. All kinds of important stuff for your day-to-day lives. Physical therapy is a crucial aspect of healthcare, and it's one that I think most Americans would struggle most to access because you got to pay out of pocket for it most of the time. You can't afford to take the time off to go and spend the hour, you know, that it takes to actually do any real work, or you can't afford to travel to the places it's provided. And yet, our Congress full of millionaires who really know what the good life is, it's worth pointing out here, full of millionaires, they make damn sure to provide themselves with exactly these services while working, actively working, breaking a sweat to deny them to the rest of us. I got to take a minute here, Bob. I want to pause and do a special little exercise because, listeners, I can't say all the swear words I'd like to say right now about this government and about every single person across both major parties in a position of leadership in it. So I'm just going to take a deep breath. And you out there, think of all the curse words you want and just apply them in your heads for me. Ah, it's cathartic. It's cathartic and it's going to save my career, Bob.
You know, I used to play basketball at the Rockford YMCA here, Michelle, and up on the wall at the basketball court, it had like alternative words to swearing. And I always just remember fiddlesticks was up there. So if you want to throw out a very angry fiddlesticks, now is your opportunity.
I don't think saying those fiddlesticks is really the same. But if you can think of another, you know, I don't know. That doesn't have the same ring to it.
My soft Midwestern ears, Michelle, that was pretty harsh there. That's going right at those Congress people. But yeah, I mean, what to say at this point? I mean, we'll talk more about the COVID relief bill that was passed late last night, later in the show with Alan McLeod at the 1 p.m. hour, which I'm really looking forward to. But man, how people just feel unrepresented. I mean, if it's about democracy, which means trust in governance and trust that those you vote for represent you, and you look at these types of bills that are going through right now, you look at Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, these young congresspeople getting the vaccine, you look at them doubling the amount of money to go towards their exclusive health care, and you're saying, how in the world are these people representing me? And it's all a sham anyways, but if the whole idea is to always make it look like there's not a sham going on, clearly, I think Congress and the government are just like giving up on the illusion at this point.
No, I mean, it's also to make the case that the government, the people who are represented in our government are the people who our government takes care of. So there you go. You know, takes care of the people who already have power and already have money. It's as simple as that. But Bob, our buddies at the New York Times, they're not finished congratulating these ghouls on the COVID bill they just passed. And they think what we want to read today is a little more hero worship, and specifically of centrists in Congress. Wouldn't you know it, Bob? The bill that passed last night was done, according to the Times, with a dinner, a deal, and moonshine. How the stimulus came together. The Times also tells us it took an empowered bipartisan group of moderates to help bridge the divide. Sit with that a minute, Bob. They are really just full time lifting the language of therapy, the language of activism, to apply it again to the most powerful, the wealthiest, the most empowered people in the country. In this article, we are talking about multimillionaire Joe Manchin of West Virginia. We're talking about multimillionaire Mitt Romney, multimillionaire Susan Collins, Dick Durbin of Illinois with slightly fewer millions, but still more than one, and millionaire Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. These and a few others came together valiantly, I'm repeating that word in this monologue, and I don't care, to fight to bring the American people what is acknowledged to be poverty level assistance. in terms of this extra $300 a week unemployment bonus and this $600 of aid. And even if we take the word of Democrats that this bill is supposed to just get us through to March, it is still a joke. But the New York Times wants us to see these moderates as the heroes who got something done instead of the frauds and hypocrites who have handed us a trash sandwich and want us to smile while we eat it. All while they, again, can drop by their in-house physical therapist anytime they want to massage the kinks out of their money counting muscles. Bob, I need a bad word break again.
Just trash sandwich?
Yeah, man. Trash sandwich. It's got those two short A's in it. It's really American. It's my favorite part of English is that A sound.
Just out of curiosity, with a trash sandwich, like, is the bread normal bread and inside of it is trash making it a trash sandwich, or is the bread itself even trash? Like, the whole thing is just trash.
The bread is two paper plates that have old pizza grease soaked through them. And inside is $3, so like, but the $3 are put together with, like, bits of human hair and old chewing gum.
Ooh. It's kind of like Fire Festival, then the box lunches that were provided to those people on the fire on Fire Island. Got it. Noted. Trash sandwich all around. Other big news out today. Speaking of government continuity, Joe Biden continues to name more members to his cabinet, the latest being Miguel Cardona to head the Department of Education. Cardona's rise is quite impressive if confirmed by the Senate. He will have gone from assistant superintendent in Meridian, Connecticut, a district with 9,000 students, to Secretary of Education in less than 2 years. Biden fulfills his promise of naming a former teacher to the post. Cardona began his career as a fourth grade teacher and rocketed up the ranks, becoming the state's youngest principal at the age of 28. He was named the state's principal of the year in 2012. Cardona's nomination comes at a critical juncture for education in the country as teacher unions and local governments battled to reopen schools. While Cardona did challenge teacher unions in Connecticut to reopen schools, it was not seemingly done in an adversarial way, leading Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, to describe him as a very, very solid candidate. So solid that a windstorm couldn't blow him over. So let's get him a jab and get the show on the road. It will be fascinating to see what role Cardona is given within the administration. The education secretary usually falls outside of the spotlight of other higher profile cabinet picks. But given Biden's call to resume in-person teaching within his first 100 days in office, Cardona may find himself in the limelight. Michelle, you know, the comparison here with it's interesting is kind of the Pete Buttigieg I was telling you earlier. Pete Buttigieg, young man, very little experience, goes into the Department of Transportation. Cardona here, also young man, late 30s, I believe, early 40s, also going from assistant superintendent of a town with 9,000 students in a matter of 2 years, the superintendent, secretary of education, a cabinet position. And I feel better about this one. One, I just don't like Pete Buttigieg. I don't like the fact that he ran for president. And the reason he didn't go anywhere is because Black people hated him and people of color did not trust him whatsoever. And he's also going from mayor to then transportation secretary, which is like not the pipeline. He wasn't a bus driver who then became the director of WMATA in Washington, D.C., or large transit system anywhere in this country, to then transportation, where he kind of just jumps over. And that seemed like more of a posturing position to help Buttigieg in the long run. Cardona, again, big time promotion here, but at least he's like going up through the ranks of education. Like, that's his hyper focus his whole life.
Yeah, I mean, it does make a little more sense. You know, Bob, you put me through kind of an emotional roller coaster there because I was imagining Pete Buttigieg as a bus driver. And I was about to say, if that had been his trajectory, I would have liked him more. But then you put him at head of WMATA, which is notoriously bad. And I went, no one loves the head of WMATA. They're all terrible. And actually, you know, that's probably a role Pete Buttigieg would fit right into. So, seems like it makes a little bit more sense. But we've said multiple times on this show already, this is just obviously an internship program for Pete Buttigieg. And they're just going to put him somewhere where people couldn't kick up too much of a fuss, but it was high profile enough for him to seem to get something done and just let him stay in government and kind of, you know, twiddle his thumbs and, you know, put together some more weird word porridge until we can nominate him for president again.
Yeah, and it's funny too, if Pete Buttigieg had been a bus driver, how much more relatable he would be to people that he might be president right now. So, you know what? Shout out to Nicolas Maduro driving the buses and now being president of Venezuela, unlike Pete Buttigieg. Michelle, let's take a break and then
Bob,
get
what's I bet there are members of Joe Biden's administration who would be happy to install Pete Buttigieg as interim president of Venezuela.
Yeah, we'll see. Give it a few months here to see why Joe Biden will change very little when it comes to its U.S.'s relation with Venezuela. Michelle, let's get the guest for our next segment on the air. Without further ado, let's take one quick break before we get to that. In the first hour, we're going to be talking about a potential breakthrough in holding polluters accountable for their impact on individual health. We're also going to talk about Mexico's new law curtailing the activity of U.S. agents on its soil and how that's being presented on this side of the border. In the second hour, we'll look at the sanctions the Trump administration is sneaking in before it says goodbye. We'll talk a little bit about what got passed last night along with this COVID bill. And of course, we'll have our weekly Politics of Art segment, taking a look with the great Jacqueline Lukman at the Small Acts Anthology series. We'll have all that and much more over the next 2 hours here on Political Misfits. We're on Radio Sputnik, live in D.C., and we're back after this.
On Radio Sputnik, where we bring you news, politics, and culture without the red and blue treatment. I'm Michelle Witte here with Bob Schlehuber, getting our show rolling today with what looks like a little bit of good news, a victory in the fight to connect air polluters to the deaths they cause. And so to talk about this particular victory in the form of a UK coroner's inquest, Bob and I are joined by Tina Landis, environmental and social justice advocate and author of Climate Solutions Beyond Capitalism. So, Tina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, last week, Tina, in what is being called a landmark case, a coroner in the UK ruled that air pollution was a cause of death for a 9-year-old London girl. Philip Barlow, who was the South London coroner, said Ella Kissy Deborah's death in February 2013 was caused by acute respiratory failure, severe asthma, and air pollution exposure. Coroner said, over the course of her short life, emissions of nitrogen dioxide exceeded EU and national safety thresholds in the town where she lived, and that particulate matter levels also exceeded WHO guidelines, and that that kind of pollution both induced and exacerbated her severe asthma. And so this story jumped out to me because while, of course, the whole point of controlling environmental pollution is to protect ecosystems and human health, and I feel like we can see statistics about excess deaths due to air pollution in particular all the time, it seems actually difficult and rare to pin pollution down as a cause of death in an individual. And so I wonder, Tina, if you could talk to us a little bit about the significance of this case.
This is great that they are pursuing this lawsuit. This young girl lived just 30 meters from the South Circular Road in London, which is a very, very busy, high traffic area. So her death was linked directly to vehicle emissions. And this is a great example of environmental injustice, where poor communities and communities of color are forced to live in these highly polluted areas with little response from the government. And of course, children are more vulnerable. Their lungs are still developing. So this is, why she was impacted so dramatically. But just to say, I don't know the exact environmental regulation laws in England, but as far as in the U.S., the air quality regulatory agencies here in the U.S. have no control over traffic. They can set standards for new vehicles, but they have no control over how many cars are on the road or expanding public transit. So that's like a completely separate agency. So how do you solve this issue of traffic and the pollution that's causing and killing people? But really, these citizen lawsuits are the most powerful way, along with protests by the people against these polluters. But in this case, it would be, protest the city for not doing something about traffic reductions. But really, in the U.S., there's these air quality standards that are set for different pollutants by the EPA, but there's really no repercussions if local regulators exceed those standards. The only action that's really taken is when there's a citizen lawsuit. So this is good that this is happening, but it's such a a widespread problem under the capitalist system where corporations really decide where they want to move and the cities are just regulating them, but not really.
I want to come back before we move on to this point you raised about being unable to regulate traffic. I mean, if that is, it certainly does seem to be in this case, a cause of death of this girl. What mechanisms are at least under discussion for controlling traffic emissions in this country or in California or that you're aware of?
Yeah, so in California, there's, you know, the state level sets goals and sets emissions standards for sort of, you know, new vehicles. And we have what's called smog checks. So your emissions, you have to get your car checked every couple of years. But really, there's no cumulative perspective. So there's millions of cars on the road every day. So even if all of those fit under the standards, the cumulative impact of all that traffic is the highest source of pollution in the Bay Area where I live. But yeah, there's nothing, there's no power within the government to cut down the number of cars, to force people to take public transit or to expand public transit so people have access. So it's really, yeah, it really needs to be looked at in a centralized way where the government has the power over how many cars are made, how much public transit is you know, expanded, and funds it and plans it in a comprehensive way, because otherwise it's just a free-for-all and no one's really, you know, taking the blame. There's piecemeal solutions, you know, there's incentives for people to buy electric vehicles, but that's such a low, you know, that's a band-aid on a big, big problem.
It also seems to me important to note in the story that the girl's mother fought for years for a second coroner's inquest into Ella's death. She died in 2013. So I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit more about why it can be so difficult to pin pollution down as a cause of individual harm and the forces that you're likely to go up against if you try to do that.
Absolutely. So you'd be fighting, I mean, I'm not sure in the case of her lawsuit, but you know, if let's say you think your cancer came from this polluter down the street, you have to be able to prove that it was the emissions from that factory that caused your cancer, as opposed to, you know, a lifestyle issue or, you know, another source of pollution. I mean, these neighborhoods that are impacted tend to have many, many sources of air pollution in them because they're poor communities, and that's where the polluters move. So it's very, very difficult. Speaking of, in this area where I live, West Oakland is the most highly impacted region in the Bay Area, which is a very wealthy area. It has the highest rates of asthma, highest cancer rates, heart disease, stroke, much greater than anywhere else in that county. Even just miles away, there's a 10-year life expectancy difference between West Oakland and the Oakland Hills, which is a white affluent area, and it's just miles apart. And it's because West Oakland is surrounded by freeways, the port, all these diesel trucks and factories, industries in that neighborhood. But it's really shocking. And this is in a very, very wealthy area and a very wealthy country that could actually address it.
It's just somehow bizarre to me that we can all kind of, I think if you asked a person on the street, does pollution contribute to ill health? Everyone would go, yeah, sure, of course. We live in a polluted area. It's probably going to have respiratory problems, cancers, whatever. But when it comes to actually going, okay, well, in this specific case, pollution specifically contributed to this death, that seems to be like one big final hurdle. And I can only imagine it's because it would introduce a whole new level of liability on these polluters. Is that right? Am I getting close to something here?
Yeah, that's part of it. And part of it is the government doesn't really have the power to control corporations. I mean, they can set regulations, but in the end, those corporations will just move to another state where the regulations are weaker, or another country where the regulations are weaker, and then that city will lose that tax base. You know, it's like the corporations really hold cities and areas in the country like hostage for this money. And the government really doesn't have the power over them.
Right. I am reminded of this ProPublica story from last year about Louisiana's Cancer Alley and a town in that area called St. Gabriel, which noted that the state of Louisiana attempts to track all cancer cases, and it claims that there are no clusters near these particular plants in question in Cancer Alley. But of course, you know, finding these clusters depends on the way data about that cancer is aggregated. And as ProPublica in this story points out, In this case, it is aggregated by census tract, which it notes are irregularly sized areas across which some emissions can vary widely. And also that, you know, in the process of protecting privacy, some data for less populated areas, including St. Gabriel, a town that they are, you know, suggest does actually have some of these clusters, that data isn't necessarily published. The specific locations of cases isn't revealed. And so this all seems to me one of the ways that polluters get an assist by the state to hide the impact of what they're doing, you know, wittingly to some degree, unwittingly to some degree.
Yeah, absolutely. And Louisiana actually has looser air quality standards than the EPA has set. So if they really want to do something, they could at least abide by the EPA standards. But, you know, Louisiana is known for Cancer Alley, for all these petrochemical companies and industries and poor communities that really have no, you know, they don't have the political power to fight back. I mean, unless they get together and really, you know, build a movement. But yeah, it's true. Like a lot of the regulations look at, I'm not sure about specifically in Louisiana, but generally regulations look at, you know, an industry will open up, they'll file for a permit. You'll look at the emissions from that one industry, that one factory, but they're not looking at the cumulative impact of the other factory that's next door and, you know, all the traffic and the port or all the different things that are polluting in that neighborhood, which is really, it's crucial because these factories don't exist in a bubble and people are surrounded by lots of different emission sources. So yeah, I mean, it really needs to be a centralized planned economy that determines what's needed. And, you know, do we need all these petrochemical companies? Do we need all this industry making plastics that we are polluting the planet with? Probably not. But there's no plan. There's no grand plan. It's the corporations are producing what they want, when they want to make a profit. The billionaires are deciding what's produced. But it really, to really tackle pollution, you need to have a plan and look at what's really needed. And that way you can cut out what isn't needed and cut that pollution.
But I think also something that potentially gets forgotten about when we talk about environmental issues is the role that labor can play in putting pressure on bad actors. It seems to me that there would be either formal unions or groups of workers around the country who could start pulling some of those levers that need to be pulled. And so I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about what organized labor either is doing already on the environment or has the potential to do in this country.
Yeah. So unfortunately, a lot of times it's the dialogue is around, you know, layoffs versus environmental protections. So it really pits the workers who work for these industries against the communities, as opposed to cutting the CEO's salaries, they would lay off workers. I don't know of any specific labor movements that, you know, that are fighting big polluters because it tends to be more community-based. The communities are impacted. But, you know, you can look at Standing Rock. You can look at all these, you know, the fossil fuel protests. Those are important. More of the community level, you know, this blocking these industries, that's because that will hurt their profits just as much as a labor strike. It would be great. We need to build with labor. We need to, you know, expand the climate justice movement and environmental movement to include labor and win them over because it's so often the labor of fossil fuel industries particularly are pitted against the community. And it's really short-sighted because in the end, we all live on the same planet and breathe the same air. So those workers are going to have the same impacts as well. They may have a job, but they may also, you know, have a shorter life.
Yeah. Hey, Tina, it's Bob. Thanks for being with us as always here on Political Misfits. You know, I'm thinking about where are some creative avenues that we can turn to push back on what is taking place to the climate. I think about Giuliani versus United States, the climate kid that made so much noise the last few years, suing Donald Trump, suing the U.S. government for taking away their right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness because of their climate actions, was basically saying, hey, in 10, 20 years, you're not going to have the opportunity to pursue those issues because there's not going to be a planet here. And so I thought it was a really creative way to come at fighting climate change. We've obviously seen the Extinction Rebellion use creativity to its fullest in different ways in which it's tried to slow down action. And we're seeing other pipelines now in the United States once again being protested. So I'm curious if you have any ideas or creative ways in which we can maybe, I want to say maybe not rethink, but re-energize or at least add some different angles to fighting climate change.
Yeah, the youth climate movement definitely has some creative ideas, and it's great to see young people really standing up and really getting it, you know. They see that the system is not working and that they don't won't have a future. Yeah, more of that. I mean, and building and linking, you know, linking the struggles, linking the indigenous communities to those youth movements, linking, you know, these communities like in Louisiana, you know, reaching out and building solidarity across borders, not just, you know, separating people by geography or nationality. We really need to unite on this because it's happening everywhere. And these corporations are polluting the entire planet. You know, that you kick them out of your neighborhood, they're going to go to someone else's who has less resources to fight back. The lawsuits are great. Definitely continue those. Not everyone has the capacity to file a lawsuit, but, you know, grassroots building, continue to build. I mean, it's becoming more and more crucial as we see around the country with wildfires and hurricanes and floods and, you know, extreme weather. It's becoming more of an issue, and these corporations are just continuing on as business as usual, and continuing to pollute our neighborhoods. And government is really not really taking any meaningful action at any level, even in the most progressive. I mean, California is supposed to be the cutting edge of environmental action, you know, as far as in the government, and it's piecemeal. It's not enough. You know, expanding electric vehicle use is not going to save us. It's another Band-Aid.
Tina, before we let you go, I wonder if, you know, this victory in the UK, even though it is limited, means anything to the rest of the world. Because I'm just wondering how important global trends are when it comes to environmental law and regulation. Because obviously we all have different legal systems, but it does seem like changes to laws or tolerance for issues seem to spread, at least among allies or culturally similar nations. So could we in the U.S. see this as a bright spot, even though it happened in the U.K.?
Absolutely. You know, any lawsuit like this that has this kind of victory, it sets a precedent. And there's something that you could point to if there's another legal case like this anywhere in the U.S. or Europe. But yeah, I mean, there was another case where I believe the worker who won a case against Monsanto, which is now, I believe, under Bayer, against being poisoned by glyphosate and getting cancer. So there are these cases coming up where people are winning against these corporations, and there needs to be more of it. And it does set a precedent, and it becomes the more victories, the easier it is to win.
Well, that sounds good. All right. Author and environmental advocate Tina Landis, thank you so much for joining us again. And where should our listeners go to find more of your work?
They can go to liberationnews.org. They can find my book there as well as some articles I've written.
All right. Thank you so much. And of course, you're listening to Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik. We are live in D.C. and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik, where we bring you news, politics, and culture without the red and blue treatment. I'm Michelle Witte here with Bob Schlehuber, now closing out our first hour here on the show with a look at the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico, how a new set of reforms to Mexico's national security law could change that relationship, and whether Joe Biden is already walking back some of his campaign promises on immigration. Joining us for this conversation is community organizer Maru Mora Villalpando, an immigrant to the U.S. and founder of La Resistencia, and Carlos Castaneda, a San Antonio-based attorney focused on family and employment law. So thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to start here talking about Mexico's apparent effort to control the work of U.S. officials and agents inside Mexico and the way that's being covered. This caught my attention with a Daily Beast story that put it this way: the winners are the cartels. Mexico slaps cuffs on the DEA. But then you get into the story and it looks like a country that is just trying to place some restrictions on the actions of foreign agents within its borders. So the Daily Beast here is appalled that the reform strips diplomatic immunity from U.S. agents in Mexico. But I thought diplomatic immunity was for foreign mission staff and not for the DEA and the FBI. The law also says foreign agents have to apply to Mexican authorities to carry a firearm in Mexico, and they have to share information they gather with Mexican officials and federal authorities, none of which sounds shocking to me. So, Carlos, I want to start with you. I mean, I understand that a lot of the arguments against this are going to be that the Mexican police are corrupt, the security forces are badly trained, information is going to get to violent cartels, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But it also seems to imply that U.S. federal agents previously had carte blanche in Mexico, and I can understand how that could also cause problems. So I wonder if you can tell us just a little bit about the current security cooperation between Mexico and the U.S. And what the effect of this bill will be.
Absolutely. First of all, the two main things to keep in mind in terms of what's happening at this particular moment is the great push by the Mexican army, the military, rather than the police, in favor of this law. The second matter is the issue that Mexican-U.S. cooperation in terms of law enforcement, in terms of drug investigation, has been going on for quite a couple of decades now. And there truly is a great degree of bilateral agreement defining what U.S. officials can and cannot do. So carte blanche, it is not, even though politically speaking, it has been described as such as by some of the supporters of the current bill that was just passed by the Mexican Congress and is expected to be signed by the Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Now, it's also very interesting to note the timing of this. Now, when it comes to recent events, many of your listeners may have kept in mind when perhaps the most important member of the Mexican military, General Cienfuegos, was arrested and indicted in the United States due to alleged links with drug trafficking, and then under threats by Mexico to essentially retaliate by ending any cooperation with DEA agents and others in the country of Mexico. The United States relented and returned General Cienfuegos to Mexico, where he was subsequently released. Now, the same threat that Mexico made, the Mexican government made, I should say, if General Cienfuegos was not released by U.S. custody, and it should be noted this operation by the United States took place without informing Mexican authorities, the exact same thing that Mexico threatened to do, it is now doing and implementing through the legislation that is expected to come into effect.
So you think that the framing of this bill in U.S. media as retaliation is at least partly correct?
I actually would not call it as retaliation, because in retaliation, you have to have a situation in which you have been hurt and the other side has not given something in return. In this situation, what the United States strategically chose to do was to return General Cienfuegos in order to avoid problems, but the problem still came. So it's actually more closer to a bit of a strategic double cross, the one that I think would have happened, would have led up to, even if General Cienfuegos was not arrested and indicted in such a public manner in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot of articles on this topic warning that the change is going to send the U.S.-Mexico security relationship back into a deep freeze. And the Daily Beast, for example, is gravely insulted that U.S. officials would have to seek permission in Mexico to do anything at all. And Maru, I want to bring you in here because we talk a lot on the show about how the U.S. throws its weight around globally. And I think Mexico is a really interesting example of this because, of course, it is our next door neighbor. And at least in the outlets that I have seen covering this issue, there is a attitude of sort of shock that Mexico might want to maintain any kind of sovereignty at all. So, Maru, I wonder if you could talk about the U.S. attitude toward Mexico generally, and what AMLO is doing or isn't doing here to try and challenge that.
Yeah, I mean, there's always been this intervention, the intervention of the U.S. in our countries throughout the continent. This is not new. It has a history, right, of intervention and taking over our governments. The fact that U.S. has really authority over Mexican nationals, not only the U.S., but in our own country, and even they have authority over other nationals not from Mexico. So, for example, the fact that Mexico has always allowed the U.S. to come in and act in really whatever way they want, not only politically, but also in law enforcement, has extended to Department of Homeland Security officials that for years now been stationed at the border with Guatemala, And as migrants try to come into Mexico to then get to the U.S., they're already fingerprinted by the Department of Homeland Security, and that has been allowed for a long time. Like Carlos mentioned, this is not new. Now, if we think about this quote-unquote cooperation between the U.S. and Mexico in regards to drug enforcement, well, that hasn't worked, has it? I don't know why people are surprised that Mexico is trying to do something, because if we have seen bigger and bigger numbers of violence and crimes, people being killed, it has to do also with the fact that the arms are being bought in the U.S. In Mexico, it's much more difficult to locate arms. It's not like in the U.S. that you can go and buy one in any store. So the U.S. politics have always been really the fuel for the violence, the corruption in regards to drug cartels, and also the fact that the military and the police have been trained by the U.S. I was really laughing about when they say that it's ill-trained. No, they're very well-trained, not only in the military sense, but also in the political sense. There's the ideology of the war against drugs came into Mexico thanks in part to the U.S. war on drugs that started with Nixon. So Mexico has always been extremely way too nice to the U.S. And I think AMLO has won this presidential position thanks to the fact that he was calling for sovereignty of Mexico, and to ensure that the U.S. wouldn't have this big intervention that they have had until now. So many of us are really happy to see this kind of action from the Mexican government.
Yeah, I mean, to follow up here with you, Maru, these articles that I was encountering on the subject all express variations of the sentiment that this is going to be bad for Mexico, which makes me wonder first, who in particular, who in Mexico are these writers worried about? Who is it going to be bad for specifically? And I feel like it also illustrates how comfortable the U.S. is telling other countries that we know what is best for them, whether they are next door to us and countries we share a long history with or across the world. And interestingly enough, what's best for Mexico or Venezuela or Iran or Djibouti or wherever is invariably for American officials and American business interests to be able to operate with minimal restriction, which I just find to be too much of a coincidence to really believe.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, if anybody is not going to be happy with this or it's going to impact this, it's going to be U.S. Officials, law enforcement that have free reign in Mexico. Not only we have seen more and more U.S. Nationals going into Mexico, really buying land. Sometimes they don't even have to buy it, just by the fact that they can stay over 5 years in a property and claim it's theirs. Back in the day, years and years ago, decades ago, people that were not Mexican nationals were not permitted to buy land, specifically also in beach coast areas, and now they do. So in a way, they have not only taken over the country in the sense of political and law enforcement, but also literally they are now property owners of Mexico. So we're talking about people that mostly will come from the U.S., that mostly have, they're very wealthy, that they have very wealthy interest, really interest of maybe even corporations, because they also serve as security for big corporations. And really, when they talk about that Mexico and, you know, many other countries, we don't know what we're doing. I just want to bring back the point of training. The big cartels like the Zetas were part of the military in Mexico, which were trained by the U.S. So this is kind of what happened in Afghanistan and in the Middle East with the training of Bin Laden and all these other, very extreme efforts to get independence from the U.S. It's always been the U.S. coming in and quote-unquote training, giving all these weapons, and then people end up using them, of course, and the U.S. doesn't like when people end up using them against them. But really here, the benefit, it is for Mexican nationals that we can also defend ourselves from law enforcement that come against us, or even, there's been many cases where nobody wants to investigate, because when we have feminicides that is happening everywhere, you know, women being killed left and right in Mexico, and when it has to do something with a U.S. National, nobody wants to even touch that story.
And also, you know, in this conversation, Carlos, I don't want to minimize the violence that a lot of people do live with every day in parts of Mexico, or how frustrating it would be to feel like you have no legal recourse to counter criminality in your community. And so I wonder if anything has proven successful at combating this kind of organized crime, and is there anything that hasn't yet been tried that might work, since this problem seems to be intractable?
Well, at the heart of all this is the sharing of information for the purposes of either reducing crime or reducing impunity. And that's the main concern by many officials who see this as something that would increase the level of impunity by certain authorities in Mexico, especially in the military. And again, because of this situation where it is now, and because the desires for sovereignty are understandable desires, this is something in which it's not necessarily a point of no return, but will definitely complicate the sharing of information when it comes to this. And also, it is something that will hurt Mexico, given how the United States is not just an information gatherer, gathering information from Mexico pursuant to these bilateral arrangements, but also provides much useful information to Mexican authorities as well. And as part of this bill, in limiting the ability of certain United States agents in Mexico, this would also impair the ability of Mexican authorities to obtain valuable information in order to combat drug cartel violence and other crimes in Mexico itself.
So what, in your opinion, would be a better approach here?
If the main issue here is maintaining sovereignty, without going into details, arranging changes to how the bilateral arrangements in existence would operate. However, if the goal, the main goal, is to reduce impunity, then this bill, the way I have seen it, it does not go in the right direction. And as an immigration lawyer who has many clients coming in from Mexico and working on their deportation defense cases, the level of impunity by Mexican authorities is something relevant in any asylum case that I may litigate. And so those are all issues that come into play, not just when it comes to the relationship between governments, but how they affect the individuals on the ground as well.
Let's also talk about immigration, because Joe Biden and AMLO last week agreed to work on a new approach to immigration that would supposedly focus on issues driving migrants out of Central America. And then yesterday, we had the news that Biden's team appears to be walking back some of its day one campaign promises on immigration, saying things like they won't immediately roll back asylum restrictions at the border with Mexico and some other restrictive Trump administration policies. Susan Rice said migrants and asylum seekers absolutely should not believe those in the region peddling the idea that the border will suddenly be fully open to process everyone on day one. It will not. So Mario, I want to ask if you see this as just an acknowledgement of reality, that implementing these changes will take time, or is this an indication that we won't see as much change on immigration as Biden had perhaps led people to believe?
I believe it's the latter. You know, let's remember that the crisis of immigration policy in the U.S. was created by the same government that is now speaking. You know, the both Democrats and Republicans are guilty of the 11 million of us stuck here. We always make fun of, they don't like us with no papers. They could have given us the papers years ago. And this is something that the Democrats keep using all the time, deterrence. How has that worked? You know, I think that we need to remind your audience, this is not a new conversation, and the talking points they use are not new either. This is a long-time conversation. They always bring back comprehensive immigration reform, really the zombie of it that has never materialized, because it's always been under the premise that first you need to militarize the border further. Second, you need to give into corporations who wanted free disposable labor. And third, continue fueling the detention and deportation machine. And then later, maybe we can talk about some sort of regularization for everyone in the state, in the country. And so what we see, and we knew from the very moment we fought against Trump, we won against Trump, yet we knew that Biden coming in will try to repeat what the Obama administration did. Let's remind our audience again. The Obama administration did not create this machine, but they really expanded it. It was under Obama that we start seeing the expansion of detention centers, including family detention centers. And so we knew that he coming, Biden coming, would be make it more difficult for us, because a lot of people would think, okay, now it's done. We don't have Trump. We're going back to be nice to immigrants. No, we weren't nice in the first place to immigrants. And so for us now, the efforts to pressure Biden to do not only undo the Trump administration horrors, but to actually undo the enforcement of immigration, the detention machine, the deportation machine, and the fact that ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, became Trump's police against immigrants activists like me, has to be done. And we know that a lot of people that voted for Biden think, okay, we're done. He won. We can go back home and stop organizing. Now we need them all more than ever to continue pressuring this new administration.
And of course, speaking of that border wall, you know, Congress snuck in $1.375 billion for a wall on the southern border as part of that omnibus spending bill for the next fiscal year. And it's sort of being seen as trying to sweeten the deal for President Donald Trump to get him to sign it, because, of course, this wall has been his a pet project of his administration. But I think this is as much funding as they have ever given the wall after Trump is going to be leaving office. And so, Carlos, I wonder if you are if you see this as disappointing, if this is just the kind of political horse trading that needs to happen to get things done. Whether it signals anything to you about the incoming administration and the landscape of immigration that they'll be dealing with.
As the wall funding, I do believe, as you say, that it's a bit of horse trading just to get the budget finished. As to the other aspects, I want to clarify the difference between the migrant protection protocols, or the so-called Remain in Mexico policy, versus the processing of asylum cases, changes to asylum law, and as well as whether or not an individual seeking asylum or otherwise is able to obtain bond from immigration authorities. Those are a few separate issues that I deal with on a regular basis. And so just give a quick overview, the MPP, or Migrant Protection Protocol, so-called, are the ones that establish that a person is seeking asylum, but they have to wait for the court case while in Mexico, not entering the United States. This pursuant to a 1996 law that was never implemented until the Trump administration began to do so 2 years ago. And eliminating that immediately is something that a new president can do, but it has complications, and I mean beyond the political ones, in terms of housing these individuals. Because one thing, as we have seen, that the current immigration authorities do not have capacity to do is to detain and process these individuals without putting individuals in cages, in the so-called hieleras, and the host of horrors that come about with that. So I think this is more a matter of trying to gauge expectations more than anything. And I still have a lot of confidence that there is going to be some good changes in the new Biden administration, but I don't for a second expect that everything is going to change on day one, even though I would like it to.
Mm-hmm. And so as Biden's immigration team shapes up, what are you expecting from the next administration?
Two main things: changes in how often bond is granted to individuals, and changes as to the asylum policies themselves. One thing that initially came out just a couple of weeks ago was that a new regulation would be officially implemented in January, right before Biden takes office, trying to cement certain changes to asylum laws that me and many other individuals believe would be absolutely horrible. Some of them have already been implemented through immigration court decisions over the last few years, but some of them are a bit new. And essentially, that is one of those regulations that I would like a new Biden administration to take away. And in fact, Congress itself does have the right to vote by majority vote to eliminate that regulation if they have the votes and can do so within 60 days.
And Maru, just with about 30 seconds left, what would you really hope for the Biden administration when they first come in?
Well, we hope that they have listened to the transitional teams meetings that are being happening, but we're not counting on that. We're going to come really strong, and we're going to do a lot of organizing to pressure them to get 100 days, the first 100 days for a moratorium on all deportations.
Yeah, I mean, it will be interesting to see. I think some people were a little bit dismayed at the noises that are coming out of the administration already. But, you know, Biden has certainly done a lot to try to do outreach. So we'll see what the administration actually comes up with. Well, organizer Maru Mora Villalpando and attorney Carlos Castaneda very much appreciate both of your points of view. Thank you so much for joining us. And with that, we are going to take a break and turn to our second hour here on Political Misfits. We're going to be talking about what else passed the U.S. Senate last night. We're going to be talking about the Trump administration's latest round of sanctions and all of the sanctions they're trying to squeeze in as they leave. We're going to fret about the COVID mutation haunting the UK, and we'll also take a look at what made the Small Axe series of films so special. We are going to have all that and more coming up here in the next hour of Political Misfits. We are on Radio Sputnik. We're live in DC, and we'll be back right after this.
Back to Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik, where we bring you news, politics, and culture without the red and blue treatment. I am Bob Schlehuber here with Michelle Witte. Get ready to go against the grain. Lots to cover here in our second hour, including what it is like to be inside the UK right now as they deal with a variant strand of the coronavirus. What exactly is in the latest COVID stimulus bill here in the US? And later in the hour, in our weekly Politics of Art segment, we take a look at Steve McQueen's Small Axe series, now streaming on Amazon. All of that and much more. You can get in the conversation, as always, by tweeting us or sending us a message on Instagram at Sputnik Misfits, or you can give us a call at 202-521-1320. That's 202-521-1320. And if you call in right now, you'll not only get to talk with me and Michelle, you'll talk with our next guest, Alan McLeod, author, journalist, and media analyst, and member of the Glasgow University Media Group. Alan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. Michelle, how are you feeling this second hour?
I'm fine, Bob.
just fine over there.
I've been talking for an hour, Bob. That's how I am. I need to soothe my poor throat and let you take over for a little while.
All right. Alan, it's just me and you these next 30 minutes. I hope you got a lot to say here because Michelle needs some resting. But Alan, I did want to ask how you're doing and ask you about the state of affairs within the United Kingdom. I mean, Britain was all but cut off from the rest of Europe on Monday with flights and trains banned by some 40 countries and freight deliveries halted at French ports as its neighbors desperately tried to stop a fast spreading variant of the coronavirus from leaving the UK. This paired with Boris Johnson's whiplash decision to ease restrictions to then just reimpose restrictions on holiday travel seems to have led to quite a bit of panic and anxiety. So, Alan, let me just first ask, how are you doing? And then how are your fellow compatriots?
Well, I'm doing as fine as ever, but I think my fellow compatriots are a little bit annoyed. Christmas has now officially been cancelled in the UK. There are new highs of coronavirus test cases, and 500 people are dying every day there or thereabouts. Not only are there new highs, but you're still in the UK not allowed to get a test unless you're showing signs of COVID-19 anyway. So the actual cases are very much likely to be much higher than they say. Now we've got this new contagious strain going across the UK. It was for a number of days said that it's only located within London and the southeast of the country. But London is a huge city to which hundreds of thousands of people travel in and out of every day. And so the idea that this was being contained merely within one city seems pretty fanciful. And now we know the truth that it's pretty much all over the UK now. Other countries in Europe are calling us the Plague Island. I'm in Scotland, which is doing much better than England. But even countries like the Republic of Ireland are looking at down their nose at us. We've had twice the deaths that they have. We've had 10 times as many deaths per capita as Norway. And yet many of the public in this country seem to be thinking that the government is still doing an okay job. I mean, 39% of the public say that Boris Johnson is doing a good job, and that's actually up since November. And a majority of over 65s, the people in the country who are dying in record rates, 52% of them say the government is doing well. So we really are living in this crazy fantasy island where nothing really makes sense and everyone's dying.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I guess I have two questions. One, I want to ask about Brexit and kind of if this is a preview of what a no deal Brexit would look like in regards to the movement of goods and border restrictions. But let me first ask you a little bit about the media coverage in the UK regarding the virus, because here in the US, it has been awful. It's the same thing that people still think Donald Trump is somehow doing a great job. We laughed last week at people like Jake Tapper and others saying, you know what? Well, let's give credit where credit's due. Operation Warp Speed, incredible success. So maybe Trump wasn't that bad. And you got to be shaking your head like, what in the world? And then you also have NBC News and other media outlets who got slammed pretty hard when they called this new strand a mutant strand. Something about mutant really scares people. I will say the other confusing thing to me is that this variant has already been detected in Denmark, the Netherlands, and Australia, that according to World Health Organizations. And it seemingly has already reached Italy, that following the Italian health minister who said that two people arrived in the country from Britain carrying the strain. So for me, it's just like way too late to stop the spread. And I guess I just feel that so many media outlets and governments still don't quite understand that there is no containing the virus, let alone a variant that spreads 70% up to 70% more rapidly from spreading between these countries, regardless of travel bans. The virus is way, way ahead of us. But yet we still trust these governments to corral the virus by putting limited restrictions on the UK. It's like it's already in these other countries, and maybe now it's already here in the US. Maybe it even started in the US, some people are saying. But yet, Alan, these government officials are still trusted to be the guides for what we should do as a society is beyond me.
Yeah, it's like trying to furiously close the door after the horse is already bolted, you know? The one thing about 2020 has been made clear is that the official figures are always a couple of weeks behind the actual tally. You know, even as Trump was locking down the U.S. in mid-March, it was pretty clear that coronavirus had already spread throughout all 50 states, even if the testing hadn't been there, just for the simple reason that you couldn't get tested back then. And it's the same in the U.K. You know, people are saying, well, you know, maybe it's, you know, trapped just in the southeast of England. But the reality is that there's so much movement, not just throughout England and the UK, but throughout the world, especially on aircraft travel, that a virus that appears in London on Monday can be in Beijing and Sydney and Johannesburg and Rio de Janeiro and Washington, D.C. by Tuesday in no time at all, really. And so, yeah, as you said, we really need to rethink our strategies. I think certainly in the UK, we need to start talking about wearing masks permanently. There is just a remarkable laziness and lackadaisicalness when it comes to mask wearing here. I did my own little survey yesterday. I was walking down the street. I counted the first 100 people who went past me. Only 20 were wearing masks. So there's a real sort of sense in the UK that people are just sort of tired of this. And it's very worrying because we're seeing new highs of cases pretty much every week. As I said, hundreds of people are dying every day. This is looking to be a very, very bleak winter for us indeed.
What's the media coverage been like? As I mentioned there, NBC News obviously playing into people's fears, and it seems like most of the media, let's scare the bejesus out of you so you'll read our article, but it doesn't necessarily seem focused on like solving the problem and necessarily science.
Yeah, there's not much of an emphasis on the government failing or anything like that. It tends to be basically repeating what Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, or the Health Minister, or any other senior politician says. There's not really that much analysis of what's going on. There's not much criticism of those in power and how incompetent they've been and how they could have, they should have seen this coming. They had months to prepare, watching what was going on in China in December, January, February. And yeah, in the UK, the government was the last to act, the very, very last. I mean, we even had the situation where the Premier League soccer league was closing down games completely unilaterally, even though that this just is a huge cash cow for them. They were saying, listen, this is just morally not acceptable for us to do this. And yet the government was still like, yes, yes, go to these stadiums in your tens of thousands. It's absolutely fine. And it was only really after huge corporations started taking the lead on being more responsible than the government that the Johnson administration start to change their tune. But this really isn't being reflected in the media, which has been, for the most part, very much on side of the government. And I'm sure if Johnson wasn't in there and it was a Labour administration under Corbyn, that would not have been the case.
Yeah, it would have been some master plan to kill all the Jews with the virus if it was Corbyn still in office. Yeah, it would have been a little bit different of a spin there. Yeah, quite remarkable how the media has handled that. Even here in the United States, as I mentioned, Donald Trump somehow still being seen as a success story. But let me also ask you here, Alan, as I mentioned, about Brexit. Is this a foreshadow of what a no-deal Brexit would look like in regards to the closing down of borders and just the chaos of shipping goods from the UK into the rest of Europe and vice versa, getting goods from Europe into the UK?
Well, I hope not, but I think you might be right. I mean, we're already talking about having food shortages at Christmas because you know, the UK doesn't really produce most of the food it eats, so it's importing it from the continent. We're seeing huge lines of big delivery trucks stuck just in the border region, just once you get off the ports in Dover and Kent, places in the southeast of England. Yeah, I mean, Brexit, it's a bit like a divorce. It can be amicable or it can be very messy. And the government, for the last couple of years, has been blowing its own trumpet, trying to, you know, beat its own chest, saying that we're number one and Europe will fall in line. It's looking like it's going to be about as messy a divorce from Europe as it's possible to get.
Yeah. 202-521-1320. We're speaking with Alan McLeod. I'm Bob Schlehuber here with arresting Michelle Witte after working hard the first hour on Political Misfits. Oh, she's still here. She's still here with us.
I'm listening intently.
Listening intently. 202-521-1320. If you want to talk about the government's handling of the coronavirus in the UK or here at home in the United States, which I now turn our attention to. Alan, you've been thinking a lot. I've been thinking a lot about collapse or decay of the US and what it would look like, because it surely will look similar to past collapses of society, but in its own unique way. And I think we can obviously point to economic inequality and debt as one indicator of collapse. And now I think with your reporting, we can clearly see another sign of collapse is government's inability to be responsive in a timely manner to its people, but also the chaos of how laws and funding is allocated. The COVID relief bill, which was passed last night in addition to a large spending bill to keep the government open, gained the scorn of both the left and the right. Recently vaccinated Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted of the bill, quote, "This is why Congress needs to time to actually read this package before voting on it. Members of Congress have not read this bill. It's over 5,000 pages, arrived at 2 p.m. today, and we are told to expect a vote on it in 2 hours. Less than an hour later, lying Ted Cruz, a senator from Texas, tweeted the truth for a change, writing, at AOC is right. It's absurd to have a $2.5 trillion spending bill negotiated in secret and then hours later demanded an up or down vote on a bill nobody had time to read. Hashtag Congress is broken." So, Alan, I mean, you wrote quite a bit about what was in the bill, but it just seems absolutely absurd, some of the things that were included. And maybe you can share with us some of those top line items.
Yeah, sure. So the thing that's probably going to be most important to ordinary Americans is that there's going to be a means-tested check of up to $600 coming in per person, plus $600 for every child. And there's going to be a moratorium on rent evictions, but we don't know how long that's going to last. But, you know, this bill was actually just, it just came kind of paperclipped to this 5,000-page document, which was just a wish list of all the most crazy spending ideas that people in high places in Washington wanted. So, you know, there's, for instance, $500 million towards Israel, $177 million of which goes to funding a new missile system for them. There's $32 million for the overthrow of the Venezuelan government. I mean, I haven't read the bill. AOC hasn't read the bill. Nobody has, because it's over 5,000 pages. But I did spend yesterday doing a lot of control F looking for certain words in the bill. And the word missile appears 19 times in the text. Aircraft appears 208 times. Munition or ammunition 46 times. Weapon 46 times. But healthcare only appears 24 times in over 5,000 pages. And doctor and nurse only appears 5 times. And mask 0. So you kind of get an idea about what this bill is really about. There is just chapters and chapters about the sort of battleships and cruisers and frigates and aircraft carriers that the U.S. is going to push through. There's all sorts of crazy regulation. I mean, it even takes a stand on the reincarnation of the Dalai Lama, for instance. There's money for the Hong Kong protesters in there. There's 64 pages. I counted them, 64 pages of horse racing regulation going in there, talking about, you know, the length of the track, the sort of drugs you're allowed to give the horses and how you have to protect them, etc. It is just this hodgepodge omnibus bill of absolutely everything people in Washington want to get in, to which the COVID bill has been kind of paperclipped on the front and then sold to the American public. There's also a load of very kind of worrying laws that might get passed, including making a DMCA strike, which is basically sharing copyrighted music on streams like YouTube or Twitch, making that a felony, punishable by up to 1 year in jail. And there's a lot of language that sounds like they're basically going to make memes illegal as well. So this whole thing, is just this ridiculous amount of crazy laws that everybody in Washington has wanted to pass for years, and they're trying to just sort of hammer it in under the guise of this being a COVID bill. But actually, only a very, very small part of this bill has got anything to do with the coronavirus.
Yeah, provision there as well, $2.4 billion to the Space Force and $35 million in funding for sexual abstinence programs that exclusively implement education and sexual risk avoidance. So, yeah, no sex for the kids out there in America during COVID. So maybe that's actually not a horrible thing. I guess we need to be distancing. But anyways, yes, not to distract from the point that this bill is absolutely crazy. And Michelle, this is where I find it really hard to argue then that the U.S. is a democracy. I mean, this country is the U.S. is a corporate run state where special interests rule the country. I mean, the American people get $600, and that's only people with updated addresses and are not married to non-U.S. citizens. I mean, how does this not just erode trust in the government further than where we already are?
So you don't get this check if you're married to a non-U.S. citizen?
No, you remember like the first round of stimulus bills, if you were married to a non-U.S. citizen, then you didn't get the bill. You're like disqualified. So there's all these like weird subcategories and rules of people who don't actually get the stimulus check.
Yeah, I mean, I was joking yesterday that they should attach the bill to the tell Vladimir Putin to cut it out, you know, $1 trillion omnibus thing or whatever. And I should have known. I was naive. Of course, this is exactly what's going to happen. And it also just, you know, emphasizes the point that we, of course, have been making for days, that these members of Congress are lying to our faces, talking about the efforts they've gone to protect the American people. And this is a good bill, blah, blah, blah. I mean, we had Schumer stand up and say this is a good bill. We had the New York Times say this is good enough. And all these other people, you know, people who had a hand in crafting this, standing up and telling us before it was even written that it was good. And I know there's the nuance police on Twitter saying like, you can't talk about the spending bill is different from the COVID bill. But as Alan says, you know, that it was attached to the front of it and it passed in. It was one package of legislation. So it's one vote. So you are actually, if you want to vote for this bill, you've got to vote for all of this other absolute nonsense. And it is incredibly illustrative of the priorities of this administration. And I think we can safely say every administration. To see the disparity between what is actually being done for Americans and what is actually being done in terms of public health and what is being done for missiles or weapons for our allies, for, you know, curtailing people's access to technology and streaming and whatever else is in this wish list. I think it makes it, you know, clear as anything else what this government is doing, who they work for and who they don't. And, you know, the fact that they stand up and lie to our faces about it, Bob.
Yeah. I mean, Alan, we've talked a lot about on this show about how Joe Biden seemingly is just baiting the populist movement to rise up against him early in his administration by bringing in old Obama administration leaders. And so it just seems like this bill is the starting point for Biden's administration, basically saying again, yeah, we don't care about the general public at large. We really focus in on U.S. imperialism and advancing our own governance for the wealthy of this country. This bill just seems like, again, it's not going to do, I don't think it's going to do Biden any favors when it comes to staving off a populist movement.
No, and not only that, once Biden becomes president, it's going to become much harder for him to pass any sort of legislation, any sort of checks going out to ordinary Americans, because at that point, Senator Mitch McConnell has got every incentive on the board to try and block any sort of Biden administration progressive reforms, because McConnell and the Republicans want to make Biden and his administration look as incompetent and as venal as the Trump administration has been in 2020. So I'm not expecting very much more to come out of the government for a very long time in terms of stimulus and in terms of actually helping working Americans. So this might be it for quite a while.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Biden's going to be basically begging people not to start protesting early in his administration. I think maybe the honeymoon phase carries him. But after what's going to be a horrible, horrible winter and what's going to happen to be a conversation, I think, with Biden, it's going to be austerity measures once he's in office saying, look, we have no more money. We're tapped out. We can't continue to go into debt. And then obviously Republicans are going to love that Joe Biden. So I don't know what Joe Biden's going to do once he's in office. I guess obviously he has more plans than I know about, but I think it's going to be a tough start for him once he's back, like I say, back into power once he's going from vice president to president. Alan, the other conversation we wanted to have with you today was a story you wrote about at Mint Press just yesterday about the spree of sanctions the Trump administration is going out on, with new ones enacted on China, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua in the past week. Can you tell us more about those sanctions, the government's stated aims for them, and the impact we should expect to see from them?
Oh, yeah, sure. So the Trump administration in just 4 years has managed to pass over 3,800 sanctions on other countries around the world. And this latest batch since Friday, from Friday to Monday, were on China, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. In terms of Iran, the stated reason is to try and get Iran back to the negotiating table for a nuclear deal. That's what Elliot Abrams said, the special envoy to Iran of Trump.
Oh, then you can believe it.
Yeah. Of course, you'll remember that it was actually the United States that pulled out of that deal, and Iran was living up to the deal. So it seems quite odd reasoning there. In terms of Venezuela, the stated reason was a retaliation for the election that took place earlier this month, where the people voted for the government and not for any American-supported groups. In fact, the U.S. wanted the entire country to boycott the election. So, we're seeing many more sanctions coming in, but we very rarely see what the actual effect of the sanctions are. Sanctions are a bit like bombs or a war. What we see in the West is perhaps a figure wearing a tie saying, you know, I'm announcing new sanctions to improve democracy. But just like bombs, we never see the impact of them on the ground on our TV screens. We don't actually hear about the impact of sanctions across the world. I did my PhD on Venezuela, so that's the country I know best. An American UN rapporteur went to the country and suggested that the sanctions that the U.S. had put on Venezuela were responsible for over 100,000 deaths already. And that's because sanctions mean that the country can't import vital goods such as medicine. So if you've got a condition that needs constant treatment like diabetes, you're really out of luck. And people have been dying in their thousands because of these sorts of sanctions. It means there are lines at supermarkets for basic products. It means that there is no fuel for transport. It means people are going cold in the winter because there's no central heating, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the effects of sanctions are very much like what a bomb would be. They are generally considered an act of war. They're just a sort of slightly different type of war. But that's not what we see in the media. We just hear very bland statements about, you know, sanctioning people because of democracy, whether it's in Iran or North Korea or Cuba or wherever it is.
Yeah, just a quick note on JCPOA. Several countries have reaffirmed their commitment to the Iranian deal. The foreign ministers of Iran, Germany, France, the United Kingdom, China, and Russia issued a joint statement on Monday renewing their commitment to the Iran nuclear deal. So it'll be interesting to see where Joe Biden goes with that. Alan, it's quite remarkable the violence of sanctions, and these leaders and Joe Biden, they all know what sanctions do. They know that it's not just some like soft carrot to get leaders to move. They know the destruction it cost on families. I mean, the clip of Madeleine Albright in, I think, 1996 when she was on 60 Minutes, I believe, and they asked her basically, was it worth it? Your sanctions could have killed 500,000 children in Iraq. Was it worth it? And she said, absolutely, because it stops Saddam Hussein from getting weapons of mass destruction. And so obviously Madeleine Albright's well aware, everybody else is well aware, Tony Blinken's gonna be well aware, Joe Biden's well aware of what sanctions are used for. These people are evil. It's brutal. It's cruel what these leaders of our country do. And what's remarkable, Alan, is then how the media and these politicians avoid the American people from realizing what their policies are doing to other people around the world. I mean, it's incredible to me that Venezuela is treated like an issue when you talk to people in the U.S. and go, well, that's not us. We're not in Venezuela. Maduro, that's his own regime. Everything happened in Venezuela, that has nothing to do with us in the United States. Why should I care? And somehow people just don't realize that our sanctions are dictating what is happening in Venezuela almost as much as anything any Venezuelan can do within that country. How do you think the media has been able to disconnect American people from their own foreign policy decisions implemented by the leaders they elect?
Well, for the most part, it's just by not talking about them. I mean, there's really not that much foreign policy stuff in mainstream media at all. When they do talk about it, though, they use heavily sanitized language. It's always, you know, nobody talks about carpet bombings. It's always surgical stripes. Or, you know, people don't talk about, you know, terrorism. They talk about kinetic warfare. It's these sorts of words that really sanitize what's going on across the world, because they have to do this, because if Americans knew what their government was doing, they wouldn't stand for it. And unfortunately, the people around Joe Biden, if you listen to the movers and shakers around him, it sounds like he is completely on board with continuing a sanctions regime. I mean, there was a report from the Center for a New American Security, which is founded by Michel Flournoy, who was Biden's original pick for a defense secretary. They are talking about calling for a more innovative use of coercive economic statecraft. And that's exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about blockading countries so they overthrow their governments. That's what their report is about. And, you know, Reuters also recently released an article based on conversations they had with people close to Biden, saying that he was very much in favor of sanctions against Russia. So maybe we have to watch out for that in 2021.
Yeah. If, Alan, people wanted to maybe learn a little bit more about the U.S. history in Venezuela and those sanctions, any books out there you would recommend, maybe one you wrote?
Yeah, I wrote a book, Bad News from Venezuela, 20 Years of Fake News and Misreporting.
All right. We'll make sure we check that out. One last quick question, a new article you have out here on Mint Press, and I really hope our listeners go and check out your great work on Mint Press. But a new article you have out, could the next Standing Rock could be brewing in northern Minnesota. You write here in the lead, the tension is palpable in northern Minnesota, where a Native-led protest movement is getting ready to square off with Enbridge over the massive Line 3 oil pipeline being built to carry crude oil from Canada to the Great Lakes. Can you tell us a little bit more about that story and what's taking place there in Minnesota?
Yeah, so there's this new pipeline that's being built, or at least being rebuilt from the Alberta tar sands down through the northern United States. And it's going to supply more than 750,000 barrels of fracked oil to America every day. Right now, there is a huge, a large and growing indigenous-led protest up in northern Minnesota. They are trying a desperate last gasp attempt to try and block this oil pipeline from being built through indigenous lands. They're worried that the state's water resources are going to be poisoned. The oil pipeline goes across the Mississippi three times. Obviously, the Mississippi is perhaps the most important water source for the United States. It goes all the way down to New Orleans and out into the Gulf of Mexico, irrigating so much of the central part of the United States. So they see this as a real existential threat, potentially, that could really destroy much of America's water infrastructure. There are a growing number of people up there braving the sub-zero conditions to try and protest about it. And it seems that if certain things happen, this might turn into the next Standing Rock, which we saw 4 years ago.
Yeah. Wow. Alan, thank you so much for covering that story. It is so vitally important. That was Alan McLeod. Alan, where can people go to find more of you, your work, and that book online?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I write mostly for Mint Press News and Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. You can also follow me on Twitter at @AlanRMacLeod, Alan R. McLeod. Oh, and you can check out my book anywhere.
Anywhere and everywhere. Alan McLeod, thank you so much again for being with us. You've been listening to Alan here on Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik. We're live in D.C. and we're back after this. Back to Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik, where we bring you news, politics, and culture. Time for our weekly Politics of Art segment, where we take a look at the latest art and discuss how it is impacting the politics around us. Let me sneak in some breaking news before we get to our weekly segment here. California Secretary of State Alex Padilla will fill Kamala Harris's Senate seat. He'll be the state's first Latino senator. So that is out there in the atmosphere today. But with that, we do get into our weekly Politics of Art segment. This week, we look at Small Axe, a British anthology film series created and directed by Steve McQueen. The anthology consists of five original films, which tell distinct stories about the lives of West Indian immigrants in London during the 1960s, 70s, and the 80s. The first movie in the series, Mangrove, looks at the case of the 1971 trial of the Mangrove Nine, including Darkest Howe. The second film, and the most artsy and music-oriented of the series, is called Lovers Rock, a romantic tale set at a reggae house party. The third film, Red, White, and Blue, features John Boyega as Leroy Logan, an officer in the London Metropolitan Police Department who founded the Black Police Association and attempted to reform the police force from within. The fourth film in the series, Alex Whittle, stars Shea Cole as Alex Whittle, a Black British novelist who was sentenced to a term in imprisonment after the 1981 Brixton Uprising. The story follows Whittle's life from his brutal upbringing in an orphanage to his arrest in 1981. The fifth and final film that premiered last Friday, Education, is based on real-life events of the 1970s when some London councils followed an unofficial policy of transferring disproportionate numbers of Black children from mainstream education to schools for the so-called educationally subnormal. The practice was exposed by educationist Bernard Coard in his 1971 pamphlet, How the West Indian Child is Made Educationally Subnormal in the British School System. The series, for me, was timely, emotional, and beautifully written and acted. I highly recommend it, especially given its commentary on current events regarding education inequality, immigration rights, police brutality, and the time-old tale of falling in love. Here to talk more about this much-watched series is one of my favorites, Jacqueline Lukman, co-host of By Any Means Necessary. Jackie Lukman, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for saying that I'm your favorite, Bob.
My most favorite.
He means it.
Most favorite. Michelle, plug your ears real quick. Maybe my most favorite on Sputnik, but let me not get into... Michelle, you were plug the ears, Michelle. Plug the ears.
Well, y'all are all right to me, too.
All right. We're all good. We're all good here on Radio Sputnik. Jackie, thank you for taking the time to be with us today. I know you're working twice as hard there with By Any Means Necessary today, so we won't keep you long, but I was really hoping to hear your thoughts on the Small Acts series. I know you had quite a few, and you were able to complete the series along with me. Let's start before we dive into each of the individual films. What did you make of the overall arc of the story?
I loved it. I thought it was a great, intimate, very focused look at life for Caribbean immigrants in the UK at a time when they were really kind of trying to fit into British society. And it exposed some things that I suspected were pretty much similar to, you know, the experience of Black people in the United States and probably everywhere else throughout the diaspora. But I also learned a lot, too. And it was refreshing to see. The stories were poignant and intimate and really beautiful. And like you, I mean, it was really, really emotional for me to watch most of them, especially the last one.
Yeah, the last one, Education, there. Yeah, I mean, you just part of your like, I love Lovers Rock because that one's the least like sad and directly political because the rest of the four, I mean, are pretty emotionally jerking. You know what? I thought it was really neat if our listeners have watched the show The Wire. I thought The Wire was great because it took all these different angles at looking at all of these different characters and stories taking place. And The Wire was like one season was from the education vantage point. One was about policing. One was about the shipping trade. So there's all these different looks at a community through not just one narrative, but several narratives. And I thought that Steve McQueen really did that well here, Jackie, that it wasn't just here's one story that gives you one perspective, but let me come at it from five different angles to really let you see the breadth of experience of those from the Caribbean living in the UK.
Absolutely. And I think that is what makes the series so great. Even though like the one movie that I liked the least was Red, White, and Blue, I guess. And I think I liked that one the least because it didn't have sort of an ending, but I know that it wasn't supposed to. It was just from the perspective of, you know, the argument that we hear all the time, you know, if you want to change something, you have to change it from the inside, and what that looked like for Black Britons who went through this, you know, wanting to join the police force, thinking that they could change it from the inside. And you're left with this sense at the end of, you know, well, how did it work out? But that's the point. It doesn't work out. It's an ongoing struggle and fight. So, but I mean, other than that, it was like, you know, Lovers Rock to me was I thought it was my favorite, not because it wasn't so, you know, directly political. I felt like it was because you get the, you know, a lot of different narratives, like, you know, the issues of different cultural aspects, how, you know, a girl from a very strict religious family, you know, has to get around her family's rules. And then you see the class issues. And then, you know, you see the other issues of women's safety in these, you know, environments that's typical everywhere. And you have that little bit of racism from the people, you know, the group of racist white guys down the street from the party. But at the almost very end of the party, and I'm trying not to give away the plot, there is a key point in that party where a song is played that is so culturally important to the people at the party that it's almost like a religious experience for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me was like so incredibly, that is the political moment where there is this one thing that people hold on to that reminds them of who they are, what their roots are, no matter where they are in this other country that is so foreign to where they've come from, doesn't welcome them. They, you know, are outsiders. And this one song reminds them it's their connection to who they are and their home. And that is so like the experience of Black people in America. We may not have this one song, but there are so many of our traditions, especially around the holidays, that do connect us to our African roots. And we are slowly kind of learning all of that. So that's why Lovers Rock was my favorite.
Yeah, yeah. And if people don't like to watch dramas or don't have time, check out the soundtrack for Lovers Rock. It's on Spotify right now. I know I've been listening to it obsessively since I was able to catch the film a few weeks ago. So it's a great Spotify playlist. And yeah, Lovers Rock for me, Jacqueline, was powerful because it really showed what these white people in the UK hated, right? It hated other cultures. It hated the way that other people lived. It hated diversity. It hated differences. I mean, it really showed what was so precious and what was at the heart of these other cultures that for whatever reason that people could hold such animosity and hate towards it. It really kind of juxtaposes like, this is what you hate. It shows the sickness of white people. It shows the sickness of racism and colonialism, that people hate other people enjoying and experiencing love, laughter, and music. And it just shows the sickness. For Red, White, and Blue, yeah, I hear you on that one, not maybe being people's favorite. It reminded me a little bit of August Wilson's play, Gem of the Ocean, which also had this narrative throughout around one of the characters wanting to be a police officer. It was so important for him to be a Black person and be an officer to integrate Black people into society. They needed to be part of the police force that was upholding the rule of law. And there's a role of rule and law in society. And you could see the character, John Boyega's character, fall into that belief that if he was in the police force, then white police officers would see them as equals. And then they would stop brutalizing Black people, which we know plays out in 50 years later, now in 2020, that Black police officers brutalize Black people just as frequently, and that there is no changing these systems from within. Let me ask you about a couple of the other parts of the series. Mangrove, I thought that movie was powerful about the ways in which the state silences and imprisons people. And really, we forget, and I forget as a white person, that Black people are often preyed upon to commit crime. Like the police officer loves to entrap a Black person by getting them to tell them where somebody might sell drugs in the neighborhood. And then you arrest that person for conspiracy charges, or you go and buy a low amount of marijuana to throw them in jail. And here you have the police there in the UK doing everything they could to basically push these folks to the edge until they simply said, I can't have it anymore. They push back. There's kind of a fight that takes place. And then all of a sudden the police say, look, you're fighting back. We have to arrest you now.
Yeah, Mangrove was it is a really powerful, I think, example of how completely the entire apparatus of the state works against the liberation and the free movement of Black people. And we say that all the time here in the U.S., and, you know, people, depending on where your political ideologies lie, you either believe it or you don't. But I think Mangrove was a great example, a great expression of how that works outside of this country, where, you know, people, here's a business owner. He did everything right, set up a business, and the police won't stop harassing them. And then the more harassment, the more the angrier he gets, the community gets angry. They rally around him. He's even reluctant to join in, you know, in defending his own right to, you know, have his business. But the way the court system is shown as being adversarial toward people, and the way we see that the police are automatically believed. I thought it was a really, really powerful movie. I enjoyed it a lot, and I feel weird saying that because it's a really horrible story. It's a true story. And when you read the history of the people involved, you see that it didn't end with the end of that case. So that I thought that was a great springboard for this series of movies. And I think really what throughout the whole thread was the relationship that I think is more important than anything else. The relationship that we have with each other in community as these kinds of things are done to us. I think that's what I got out of each of these movies for a different reason throughout all of them.
Yeah, I loved Mangrove too, because I was introduced to Darkest Howe, who I did not know before watching that movie, as a great liberation fighter. And just the brilliance too, that we always think, oh, get a lawyer right away, when people that are oppressed are often more creative or have understandings of the law that's oppressing them better than those who are paid and studied to uphold it in many ways. The last two movies in the series that have come out the last two Fridays as Amazon has rolled them out, Alex Weedle, powerful for me to see that film and to see the arc of a child of a foster system be raised in a way that could only lead him to rebel against the state at an older age. This was a biopic that focused on Alex Weedle's life. And so, Jackie, I was curious if you knew Alex Weedle's work whatsoever and what you make of this kind of this arc of where you basically abuse a child at a young age under the state's care in these foster systems. What are you expecting that child to grow into but be rather distrustful and angry at the state when they're an adult?
I got to tell you, Alex Weedle, that one, I cried at this one, because to me, again, it's about the connections and the relationships we have to have with each other within our communities. And he had none. He had nobody. He was at the mercy of the system. And I think the scene where, and Abdus and I, you know, of course, watched it together, the scene where he goes to his friend's house for the holidays with his friend's family, and he has none. That just really broke my heart. And of course, you know, we think of all of the kids in the foster care system here in the United States. A lot of poor white kids, and, you know, certainly, but a lot of poor Black kids. And it's like that the importance of family and community and emotional connection, it could not have been better displayed, I think, than Steve McQueen did in that particular movie. And like you said, just focusing on how the police, how the system focuses on like the little petty things that people who are struggling with nothing have to do to get by. And then they turn that into a prison sentence. But it was in prison that Alex Weedle turned, I hate to say turned his life around, because I don't look at his life as going anything terrible before that, but he was given the foundation to express himself through that time in prison, through reading books and connecting with who he is in his community. So that was incredible. And I didn't know who Alex Weedle was and his work before watching this, but you know, that I'm getting a list. And I'm checking it twice to throw some of his books on there.
You're going
to
say that, Jackie. I was waiting for that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing with Alex Weedle, I mean, just a note, it wasn't the carceral system that, like, quote unquote, turned his life around. It was other prisoners grabbing him and said, don't let the time do you, you do the time. And get to reading and educate yourself, because that's the only way to fight back against these forces. The last film in our series, Jacqueline Lukman, was Education, which looked at, as I mentioned there at the top, how the system was basically indiscriminately sending these Caribbean children to substandard schools. And for this, I mean, wow, the fact that people would profit off of the miseducation of young Black children for their own profiteering, I mean, incredible how sick and evil some people can be on this planet.
I mean, you know, when we were watching it, we were like, yeah, this is what they do. So that part wasn't like shocking, right? But I think the part that we loved seeing was organizing in action, like political education in action. We talk about this all the time. You know, we talk about it on our show all the time, on By Any Means Necessary, on our platform. But if you want to see what organizing in community and political education looks like at the grassroots level, this is the movie that shows us what it is. It is setting up a Saturday school to educate kids who the system has determined can't be educated, quite literally because they think they are substandard in intellect. And not doing it to prove the system wrong, but doing it because we love our children and we know our children better than the system does. So that was incredible to me. And I loved how it ended. But again, it goes back to what I think is the overarching message through all of these movies. It's community. It's the relationships that we have in these oppressed communities and how those relationships transform, you know, through these adversities. Like the mom in the last movie was so busy working and tired and frustrated. But when she realized her child had a problem, then she became a different person and she became his advocate and his hero. And even back in Red, White, and Blue, the adversarial relationship between the father and the son, because the son wanted to be a cop, but because he loved his son. And he saw that this was important to his son, then he needed to let his son know that he loved him and he supported him. I mean, this is these movies, I think, just reaffirmed for me that through everything, Black people love each other. Because at the end of the day, no matter what the system, no matter what system we are in does to us, we know that we are all we have. So we love each other and we struggle. And sometimes we actually win.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love the fact that the overall series ends with Claudia Jones, the Claudia Jones School for Public Education. Just a quote there on their front page, "A people's art is the genesis of their freedom." That's from Claudia Jones. So a powerful kind of nod by Steve McQueen. Say, go out there and educate yourself. Go out there and organize and you can gain that power and that freedom. Jackie Lukman, thank you so much for being with us. In 10 minutes from now, folks, do not change the dial. You'll hear Jackie Lukman on By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik. Jackie, thank you so much again for your time.
Thank you all so much. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik live in D.C. We're back after this.
Welcome back to Political Misfits on Radio Sputnik, where we bring you news, politics, and culture without the red and blue treatment. I'm Michelle Witte here with Bob Schlehuber, closing out our show today. And Bob, look, this is not my usual New York Times rant. I just kind of wonder if they're okay over there, because the opinion section of that newspaper has been on a tear recently, telling us things like death is real and sex is fun, and cities are not things that are not cities. I'm serious. It's very strange. A day or two ago, Bob, we had a New York Times opinion piece that was just called "What is Death?" And I thought, well, buddy, I mean, if you haven't figured it out, I don't know if you should be writing in the newspaper. Today, it has essentially sex. It's fun. With an opinion piece called The Joys of Frivolous Sex. I mean, all right, cool. I don't think you needed to tell us that in the paper, but all right. Tomorrow, Bob, it might be food. You eat it. And today, this is a real headline. Today, the New York Times also tells us cities aren't toast. NYT, are you okay? They're not toast. They're not ponies. Cities are also not cake. I'm very concerned about the Times.
Just isn't like smelling toast like a sign of a stroke? Do they collectively have a stroke there at the New York Times?
I think they might have, honestly. I think they glitched out after having to tell us that this was a good bill. And now it's
great
just
bill.
Like
great bill.
Toes are the fingers of your feet and 600 words on it. I love it, personally.
Quite a bit of other news. Other news. I was going to say real news, but bash the
it
New York Times.
News.
That is real news here. That's real news. That's real. AP source. Justice Department filing a lawsuit against Walmart alleging it illegally distributed opioids, helping fuel the crisis. So maybe some more people will be fined because we know nobody ever goes to jail. So Walmart indicted there. That's good, at least. Other local Washington, D.C. based news. Mayor Muriel Bowser will nominate longtime police official Robert Conte III to lead the Metropolitan Police Department in the wake of Peter Newsom's planned departure. Conte has been on the force for 31 years. This seems to have upset the ACLU of D.C., who demanded that a search go beyond just Washington, D.C. to bring in somebody to change the culture of policing. They're not going to get that with Conte there for 31 years. And a recently appointed police review commission by the D.C. Council, a group of, I think, about 20 or so folks who is to offer recommendations on how to improve the police department, I guess. They were also left out of the process, given no voice whatsoever ahead of Muriel Bowser's nomination or announcement of Conte to be the next chief. So, yeah, there's more of that.
This is the kind of stuff like they tell you, if you really want to reform the police, you know, join a police review commission. And then even these, you know, relatively toothless little commissions. Yeah. Again, it shows how much weight you really have. Oh, it's, you know, they're constantly scolding people for saying, well, you're not working hard enough. That's why nothing's happening. Oh, well, I mean, but there is a police review commission. But what kind of voice do they have? Apparently none.
Yeah. And for people think Muriel Bowser's out there like listening to what people want, and no, she went ahead and she made it the unilateral decision and picked the guy she knew and she felt comfortable with. And I guess that's a prerogative of a mayor, but just don't try to tell me that Democratic Mayor Muriel Bowser cares about Black lives, because she would have gone and talked to people that are leading the movement out on the streets about this pick. And like you said, the toothless police review commission, even the slightest kind of it's a spectrum of people on this committee. It's not just people that like hate police or I've been out there in the streets. It's a pretty wide breadth of people that are part of this commission, from very conservative people that are very pro-police to people that are looking for the abolishment of police, to not even check with that commission. Also shows that you don't even care about your own allies and what they care. You're the boss in your head and you're going to move forward. Again, her prerogative. Just don't tell me she cares about Black lives. Other DC story here, Michelle. I'm not sure if you saw it or maybe you were hanging out with the guy, but the Washington football team said it was aware of pictures on social media showing quarterback Dwayne Haskins at a strip club Sunday night while not wearing a mask, and that the team will handle the issue internally. Haskins tweeted an apology saying he spoke with Ron Rivera on Monday and took full responsibility for putting the team at risk. It was irresponsible and immature, and I accept responsibility for my action. He also issued an apology to his teammates for creating a distraction during a playoff push. How do you make there? Your own home team, the Washington football team, Michelle. Mask off, tops off.
Mask off, tops off, underpants off, you know, whatever. Hey, take it all
out
off.
Of it.
Yeah, big news here. Strip clubs are open in D.C.? I didn't.
Do strippers wear masks? I mean, I guess if, like, your genitals and your breasts don't spread the virus, like, who cares if that's covered?
No, one, didn't know strip clubs were open in D.C. Two, on a Sunday. For shame, honestly.
Tough loss. Gotta let go of some steam. Yeah, Archibald's was open right next to when we were down there covering the Proud Boys infestation of Washington, D.C. a couple weekends ago. Archibald's right next to all of the action. The strip club was okay. That seems to be neutral ground is always a strip club for all sides, you know?
Yeah. But bad choice, I think. Bad choice on his part. I'll just let the team take care of it. I don't need to do any more scolding here, Bob. Bob, I got something that will warm your heart here. It's a little feather in the cap of your favorite young man, Jared Kushner, who's getting a courtyard at a U.S. embassy in Jerusalem named after him.
Gross. Gross. Finally, we know where he'll live.
Put up a little tent there. I hope birds poop in it all the time. Just birds and dogs. Yeah, a courtyard at the embassy in Jerusalem is getting a new name. It was named after Jared Kushner yesterday. Wow. And a plaque in the courtyard includes a Kushner quote from the embassy dedication on May 14th, 2018, reading, "When there is peace in this region, we will look back upon this day and remember that this journey for peace started with a strong America recognizing the truth." Honestly, just they don't make quotes like they used to. When you look at quotes from, you know, a century ago or something, they are all genuinely moving and the words are beautiful. The sentence structure is beautiful. Like it's an actual gripping emotional moment. And all the recent ones are just like, "I hope when you stand in this courtyard, you have a good feeling and you remember other times that were good." It's just like, don't bother, man. Just save the stone, carve something else on it. Don't etch that into the stone forever and ever. But yeah, there you go. So
it's an Israeli related news there. It does look like the country will head to elections early next year. Likud still a favorite to win. Blue and white, Benny Gantz. Man, you were so close. You were so close to being prime minister. And now your party just seems to be falling apart all around you. Michelle, I do have another story I wanted to sneak in real quick from Sacramento, California. A California Santa Claus is safe after his motorized parachute got stuck in power lines. Metro Fire of Sacramento says a Santa impersonator was using a hyperlight aircraft to deliver candy canes to children when he got caught. Around 200 people were without power as crews worked to save Santa. Fire Captain Christopher Bestel says the aircraft's restraints likely not only saved Santa's life, but Christmas.
Well, I mean, that's what you get when you try and, you know, fly a plane instead of riding in your sleigh pulled by reindeer. I don't know what he was thinking. Santa probably doesn't even have a license to fly an ultralight aircraft. Got to go back to the stable, get that sleigh fixed. Oh, you also know why Santa's safe, Bob. Did you see when Anthony Fauci said Santa's not going to get COVID because Anthony Fauci personally vaccinated him?
Oh, no, I did not see that. Do they air that on the news to gain our trust as well?
Yeah, Fauci was like, "Listen, kids, don't worry. Santa's fine. I gave Santa the vaccine," which I appreciate, right? I mean, Santa's got to go to all of these houses, got to say, "Ho, ho, ho." A lot of air comes out of your mouth. You know, people putting out cookies and milk. And he's an elderly man, Bob. So he deserved that vaccine.
Good. I'm glad he got it, Michelle. We got to get out of here for the day. Big thanks to our guests, as always, Alan McLeod, Jackie Lukman, Dan Kovalik, who did not join us, but I always love my Dan Kovalik, Tina Landis, Mauro Mora, Villalpando, and Carlos Castaneda. Thanks, as always, to our engineers, Ryan, Dimitri, Andre, and Saul, and the entire Sputnik news team for keeping us on air during the pandemic. Today's episode was produced by the very talented Ebony McMorris. On behalf of Michelle Witte and myself, Bob Schlehuber, thank you for listening. Now get back to organizing.